We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. Now here's your program.
And good morning. Welcome to the second hour of Focus. This is our morning talk program. My name's David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. The producers for the show, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Jason Croft, is at the controls this morning. There was a time when students who were willing to work hard could get an affordable, quality education at a public university here in this country. However, it seems those days are long gone. This morning in this part of Focus, we'll talk a little bit about what has happened with public support for public higher education and why college education continues to be important, not just for individuals, but also for America. Our guest is Nancy Fulbray. She's professor of economics at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. And we will talk about a book that she's written. The title of her book is Saving State U: Why We Must Fix Public Higher Education. That's the subtitle. It's published by the New Press. In this book, she takes a look at the difficulties state universities face in trying to teach their students in places where budgets have been repeatedly cut. And she also goes on to make the argument that public education needs support because it does more than just produce good workers. It also is something that works to produce good citizens. Questions are welcome, as always. We do ask people to try to be brief, but just so we can get as many callers in as possible. If you'd like to call and you're in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, the number is 333-9455. We have a toll-free line, so if it would be a long-distance call, you can use that one. That is 800-222-9455. And we'll also be happy to take your comments by email. Just send them along to will-talk, that's W-I-L-L-talk, at illinois.edu. And at any point here, questions by email, by phone, are certainly welcome. And Professor Fulbray, hello.
Hi.
Thanks very much for talking with us.
I'm really happy to be here.
We certainly appreciate it. This apparently is something that, a subject that you started thinking about at first because these concerns about, particularly about the funding situation and the future of the university, something that we share and a lot of people share. You really started out thinking about your own university there at UMass.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I was kind of living the story.
Yeah. Well, what has the situation been there at your school?
Well, we faced really bad budget cuts both last year and upcoming, a little bit buffered by the fiscal stimulus. But in percentage terms, our overall budget cut was one of the top two highest in the country.
Mm. You know, I think that this is something, if you talk to people in higher education, I'm sure that they would say, you know, that if we think that we're having a crisis now, this is a crisis that has been sometime in the making, and we could go back a decade more, probably, and I'm sure that we would find people who would start to be waving the red flag and say, look, we're headed in a bad direction, and if we don't do something about it now, things are really going to be bad. You can't exactly say that where we are now is a big surprise.
No, it's not. It's definitely a long-run trend, but it really intensifies during periods of recession like the one we're in now. So, you know, I guess my concern is I think we're kind of ratcheting downward. That is, we get cut during recessions, and then we don't really get lifted back up to where we were. So that really is pushing us through the floor.
Yeah, it seems that once you can get a certain level of funding established, and it just hangs. You know, it's very, and I think what you say is true. Once funding has gone down, you establish a new floor, and it's very difficult then to work your way back up to where you might have come from.
Yeah. Plus, it's a complicated time for the economy as a whole. You know, we have a financial crisis that's still kind of in play. We have really high unemployment rates. We're all really worried about, you know, what our public policies towards increased debt should be. So it's really important for supporters of public higher education to hang in there and keep fighting for attention to their issues.
Well, and I'm sure people in higher education would agree with that. I'm though interested in having you address the connection that people might want to make between the economic downturn nationally we've had over the last couple of years and what's happening with funding for higher ed. I think that I'm sure that you would say, well, that's contributed to it, but you can't really pin the one on the other.
No, I can't. But, you know, I think they're both kind of related to the a very similar process that I try to describe in Saving State U, which is a kind of shift towards a more global, less regulated economy in which, you know, the interests of consumers and workers and employers are kind of becoming a little bit more at odds. I think that's hurting public higher ed. You know, I think big business used to be a really big supporter of public higher education because they were dependent on a local labor force that was highly educated. And now the really big companies are a lot more footloose and can hire workers anywhere in the world. So it's a little bit, you know, I think there are sort of parallels with the forces that have contributed to the economic crisis.
Yeah. You know, and this is something else that you also deal with in the book. I think that it is true that most people would continue to support the idea that investing in education, at least elementary and secondary education, is a good thing, and that even people who don't have children, but certainly people who do, accept the idea that they pay taxes to support local schools and that having an educated populace is good for the community and good for the society. I think people generally accept that. But it seems that somehow that doesn't quite translate to higher education. And it seems that you could make the same kind of argument, but I'm not sure that carries the same weight with people.
Well, I think you're right, but I think that's changing. I think people realize that a college degree is kind of the new high school diploma, and especially in kind of the global economy that is really highly competitive, where our kind of economic niche is going to lie in high-tech services and information technologies. I think there's a sense that people get it, that we need to invest in public higher education to stay competitive economically. But it's true there are all these things that kind of complicate the picture. People who get a college degree do generally reap some private benefits from that. And sometimes that makes people who, you know, think, well, you know, they're getting the benefits, they should pay the costs. I think there's also a concern that, oh, what if we have an oversupply of college graduates that might drive wages down? But I try to argue in the book that neither of those arguments is really overriding, and that we still really have a strong case to make for public investment and kind of a high social rate of return from spending more on public higher ed.
Yeah. I just was looking at, now I can't remember where it is that I saw these figures, but it's very clear if you look at them graphed out that while it is true that people who have college degrees do much better economically than people who don't, I guess that may be somehow clouded by the fact that it doesn't matter who you are, that now over a quite a long period of time, wages have been flat. There's really been no growth for it.
Yeah,
that,
I think actually that's a very good description. I mean, most college grads have basically been able to defend their established wage level, whereas those in the lower ranks of educational credentials have actually seen declines.
If you then also look at what's happened with state support for public colleges and universities, and you graph that out, and you go back. Let's even go back. I don't know how far you want to go back. Maybe you go back into the 70s. Was there a time when support was really growing, and is there a certain point that you can point to and say, here's the turnaround point, that there's some point where there was growth, and then there was some point things just fell off the proverbial cliff?
Well, there's no proverbial cliff. There's kind of a plateau and then a gradual decline, and it varies a lot from state to state. I think different states are on a kind of slightly different trajectory. But you know, in general, the 60s and 70s were really the boom years for public higher ed, and enrollments were expanding, state spending was expanding, and then along come the 80s and 90s, and a lot of other demands are being placed on state budgets, especially through Medicaid, and tremendous increases in Medicaid expenditures by states. It's sort of part of the whole healthcare crisis. And then No Child Left Behind came along and imposed a lot of unfunded mandates on the states over the last 10 years. And at the same time, state revenues, for the most part, are based on very regressive taxes, taxes that take a bigger bite out of low-income and middle-income households than those at the top. And that is really a structural problem because it means that taxpayers on the state level are really, really phobic about tax increases because a large majority of those who would be affected are, you know, can really ill afford to pay. So one of the things I argue in Saving State U is that we really need to change the structure of state taxation, and I remain really committed to that argument.
And that for you, that means real progressivity?
Real progressivity, yeah. I think, you know, if you look at the income distribution in this country over the last 30 years, it has really tilted in favor of people at the top. And at the same time, we've been cutting taxes for that group. And I think that it just doesn't make sense. It's not fair. It's not efficient. And we really need to change it.
Our guest in this hour of focus is Nancy Fulbray. She is professor of economics at the University of Massachusetts Amherst and is author of a recent book, Saving State U. The subtitle is Why We Must Fix Public Higher Education. It's published by the New Press. Questions, comments, welcome. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. And you may email your comments, questions to will-talk@illinois.edu. And I think that one of the things that's really striking and interesting that sometimes you hear people talking about it is they look at the increasing financial pressures that state colleges and universities are facing, the fact that their state support has been pretty steadily declining, and the fact that really their only alternative, other than trying to find ways to save money in operations, is to increase tuition, that you get to the point where you start to question whether public universities are actually public anymore. I mean, if you're getting to the point where, I'm not sure what the highest ratio of, you know, tuition to state support, but if you start to get to where like half of your income comes from tuition, then you're really going to have to start asking this question, well, is that public education anymore?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. You know, sometimes public state universities are referred to today as state located rather than state supported. I think, you know, a lot of people don't really fully understand the extent to which tuition increases are linked to declining state support.
Mm-hmm. Well, what does all of this have to do also with not just accessibility, and certainly that's a big issue, but also with the quality of education that students receive? Because this is also something that a lot of people, and certainly people in higher ed, are really concerned about.
Yeah. Well, from my vantage point, you know, I think there's some pretty worrisome trends in terms of quality. The composition of the teaching labor force has really changed. It's now, you know, about 50% part-time and adjunct faculty, many of whom are very gifted teachers, but who don't have the time or the long-run relationship with the university and its students to really maintain a high-quality connection with them. We have this growth of really large size classes at the introductory freshman and sophomore levels. And now we have a lot of online courses. And again, you know, for some students, large lecture sections and online education works great. For others, it doesn't. Especially students that kind of lack a personal connection, a strong community, kind of reinforcement and problem-solving help, I think it can be a pretty alienating experience to be a freshman or a sophomore at a big state university. And, you know, we don't do a very good job of retention and graduation. Overall, you know, less than about 60% of our students have graduated after, you know, within 6 years. So there's a lot of attrition, and that attrition speaks to a quality problem.
Hmm. We have a caller to bring into the conversation. Let's do that. And this is someone who is in Champaign to start us off. This is line one. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
I work for a national online university, and over the 8 years that I've been with that institution, it has tripled in size. And its tuition rates are quite high. And even during the recession, its growth has continued. I'd be interested in your comments on why online for-profit education has become such a force in higher education, and what it means for traditional institutions that in the past have been state-supported or have been private institutions supported by tuition and other means.
Well, I think that's a really great question. I think that the online, the for-profit onlines really deserve a lot of credit for being on the cutting edge of innovation in getting online access out there. But I do really worry about the incentives that get put into play with recruiting and potential to profit from each student who enrolls. I worry that it can be kind of like a health club model where the incentives are to sign people up but not to care very much if they keep coming to the gym and working out. And I think, you know, like I was saying about, you know, existing problems with state universities, we have some methods that work very well for some students and not very well for others. And I think that's a problem that really is really, really serious for the for-profit online schools. So they're more successful at the course level in terms of people paying for a course and completing a course than at the degree completion level. And we also have a big problem with students who are taking, who are signing up for federal financial aid with the enthusiastic assistance of the proprietary schools, and then not completing the credentials that they need in order to be able to pay those back. So, as you know, there's a big debate right now going on over appropriate regulation of recruitment practices.
I think your points are well taken.
Well, tell me what it looks like from your point of view. I'd really like to hear what your experience has been, how you're living it.
Well, I have very highly motivated students.
What subject are you teaching?
Excuse me?
What subject are you teaching?
I teach financial management and higher education.
Uh-huh.
I have about a 90% completion rate for the courses that I teach, about a 98% completion rate for the doctoral students that I advise. And I know that there are many systems built in place to stay in touch with students and move them along, a great concern for retention. And I think that those concerns and the quality of an instruction have led to the fact that this particular institution, of course I can't speak for others, has experienced very high enrollments, jumping by 25% a quarter, and great increases in profitability, and the fact that their numbers continue to increase is an indication that
something's working.
Students are remaining. Potential students are attracted to the institution in large part by current and past students who indicate that the programs seem to work for them.
Well, my sense is that courses in financial analysis, management, and kind of business school courses, especially at the upper level, are particularly successful online, that they attract generally pretty self-motivated and also pretty students with a pretty strong background.
In addition to which, there's an attraction of students who already have positions, and they see a degree as being a way to increase their salary, move on to a higher position, and in some cases look for another position in a field that they aspire to. The other part of what is happening is that course programs can be developed fairly rapidly for specific needs, allowing an individual to get a master's degree, for example, in a highly specialized area of public health or it's not public service, but working with government, and these programs seem to have increased substantially. In March, I was at a graduation where 900 people got an assortment of degrees from undergraduate to PhD.
Yeah, I guess I do worry a little bit that one of the reasons for the rapid growth in the for-profit sector is that the nonprofit sector has been raising its prices. I mean, it's precisely the withdrawal of public support that's driving the success of the I mean, not completely, but I think it's contributing to the success of the business model that you're describing.
Yeah. I've got to go back and work with my students.
Well, I'm glad.
Well, thanks for the call.
Glad to talk with you.
We have some others here. We'll go next to Urbana in line two. Hello.
Yes, I have a question and something I'd like to quote. Perhaps a week ago on NPR, there was an interview with a man who was very desirous of seeing entrance requirements liberalized, because he said the United States needs the highly trained workers we can get from abroad because we can't produce them ourselves. And it seems to me there's an assumption there that the American people are incapable of mastering these fields. And I'm not anti-foreigner or opposed to students coming into this country, but it seems the underlying assumption that Americans can't do the job that bothers me.
Well, yeah, I hear what you're saying. Although, to me, it seems like the driving force behind kind of the debate over lifting immigration barriers for highly skilled workers is kind of more economic. That is, it's a lot cheaper. I mean, you don't have to pay to educate American workers if you can hire more educated workers from overseas.
That had occurred to me.
Yeah, and, you know, in my view, that's kind of like a short-run versus long-run issue. Yeah, sure, in the short run, it's cheaper. But in the long run, it hurts the country as a whole. And I guess I worry a little bit about that kind of cost, cost differential issue. Yeah.
The question is, do you think the privatization movement that we've undergone has seriously hurt higher education? That there's a feeling that among some politicians that private enterprise can do the job and do it cheaper, and we don't need to do it.
You know, I definitely think that there's been a pretty widespread adoption of a business model that I don't think is appropriate to higher ed, and I do think it's hurt public higher education in some ways. But I also think that the interesting thing about higher ed is it's always had kind of a complex ecology of different kinds of institutions with a lot of individual choice, and you know that can be a good thing. I mean, I recognize that large state universities, I mean, partly because I've worked for one for 25 years, can be pretty hidebound and bureaucratic and resistant to change. So I kind of like the idea of mixing things up a little bit and having a little bit of competition and controversy. But I do, having said that, I do basically feel that privatization is really in danger of undermining something very important and very precious and very worthwhile and that we really need to protect.
May I say one other thing?
Mm-hmm. Sure.
It seems to me that universities not only train people for professions, but they should also be developing citizens, particularly at the undergrad level. And the interchange between people, students in different fields, is enormously beneficial for the public as a whole. I know as a graduate student, I had friends who were physicists, chemists, philosophy majors. I was in language studies myself, and I think I profited greatly from the people I met.
I totally agree. I think that's a huge part of what we all care about in education. I think that's, you know, the commitment to that vision is what animates a lot of people who become college teachers, and we really need to hang on to it.
Well, I jumped in here. I hope the caller will forgive me. I'm a little bit past the midpoint here, and I want to introduce again the guest and get to some other folks. This morning in this hour of focus, our guest is Nancy Fulbray. She's professor of economics at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst and is the author of a book that we're talking about here. It's just recently come out. The title of her book is Saving State U, Why We Must Fix Public Higher Education, published by the Free Press.
New Press.
Oh, I'm sorry. The New Press. Yes. Well, there is also a Free Press, but they're somebody else. My apologies. I think I probably now said that wrong a couple times.
No, actually, I think that would be the only time.
All right. The New Press. It's out now in bookstores, I'm sure, if you would like to read it. Questions are welcome here. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. And email will-talk@illinois.edu. We'll go to Geneva or Oswego for another caller here on our toll free line, line four. Hello.
Thanks.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm actually looking, and maybe you can give me some advice. I'm actually looking online at taking classes online since I can't come down there. The university there has some great stuff, but you know, a gentleman was talking about private enterprise, privatization of all this, and I kind of think it's a better deal because really, all I see is political points of view being thrown at kids in college. Every time I read the paper, it seems like, or every other time, there's a point of view, whether it's a right or a left point of view, instead of just staying neutral. It seems like there's teachers or there's employees or there's administrative staff that have a problem trying to stay out of the political spectrum and try and, you know, slant what's true or not true. I have a degree in forestry, and it's not getting me anywhere, so now I'm basically going back to school again at 54 to learn another trade.
What are you thinking of studying?
Well, I want to stay with the natural resources. The problem is I can't go anywhere where it's close by. I'm up in the northern part of the state now. I used to be down there, and it's very difficult, so I'm doing online services or I'm going to private enterprise because it's cheaper. I don't have $20,000 a year to fork out. You know, I'm not working right now. I'm trying to, but
well,
54 years old.
Don't you think state universities should be providing online courses for people like you who want to retrain and develop their capabilities at a low cost?
Yeah, but they don't. That's the problem.
That's right. But that's what we need to really be pushing for is to build more political support to expand those services.
Well, I agree with you 100%. That's what I was saying. I commend you for that because I think it's to the woman to them to do it. Part of the problem is there's so many people out there out of work right now where the adults now are mixing in with the college students. And everybody's fighting for the same job, and unfortunately...
Right. So exactly. So it's a really good time for people to go back to school or to at least be taking online courses and making good use of their time. And yet, you know, at the same time, we're raising prices and cutting back on the services that state universities are providing. I think it's a travesty.
I've been going to the junior college because it's much cheaper and it's closer by. Well, Bonzi College is where I'm at. But this show, by the way, I got to say, David and the crew that put it on, and I'm a regular caller. I love it. People like you, when they bring on, gives me a wealth of information, and I can take back and go with it. And that, I hope, and I've support. supported this. I've sent in money to these people to support this. I hope it keeps going because this is a good example. We need to, like what you're talking about. I hope it does because I'd rather now educate than do the physical stuff. I'd rather use my mind and my brawn, let's say. But I'll get off and let you guys talk. Thank you very much.
Thanks. Yeah, good to hear you.
Well, and just really to pick up on the point you made, I think we people there are a lot of people who have recognized the value of some post-secondary education and what a great bargain, what a great institution the community college is.
Yeah,
we've seen these huge, huge increases in enrollment and demand that opportunity, and it's since the downturn, I think a lot of people have said, well, they do need to have additional training and education, and that's a great place to go.
Yeah, we really need to build that community college infrastructure and also get it into better sync with the four-year institutions so that it, you know, it should be easy as pie for students to continue up and to move on.
So you don't think that universities, public colleges and universities should see anybody who's offering online courses as some kind of a threat or that actually is something that they should be looking at more and more themselves?
Oh, absolutely. And they are. There's definitely a movement in that direction, which I think is really good. Although I think we need to be really careful to make sure that students have the potential to combine online courses with some FaceTime and some real-time interaction. I think it's a really great complement to the existing curriculum. I don't think it's a complete substitute for it. Mm.
Let's talk with someone in Indiana next, line 3. Hello.
Hello. A couple things. Certainly, the face-to-face experience is extremely important for the humanities or any liberal arts college. I discovered that I was given a correspondence course to take over by default because a student had some health problems, and they asked me to do it. And I had one heck of a time commuting philosophical ideas to people who I couldn't since relate to see expressions on their face or body movements to see if they really understood what I was talking about. And it got down to the place where it almost became a simple sentence instruction kind of thing for, an introductory philosophy course. It became very difficult. Now, the sort of things that you can learn by rote, a lot of technology is that way. And there it is. Either you do it or you don't. But the complexities of the human mind are a little bit different to handle. I think it would be nice to know which states are doing well. First thing comes to my mind with community colleges, North Carolina started very early and had a very strong community college. You went there 2 years, then if you had the stuff, you went on to UNC or Duke or whatever. And California did too, but its sort of things are messed up now because of its situation in relationship to Illinois debts and not paying the universities any kinds of monies. The siphoning off of the funds by the states to other kinds of education, is that of any importance or is it so minuscule it doesn't have any importance in terms of what the monies the regular state universities and colleges are receiving?
Well, I wouldn't call it siphoning off, but I think there's definitely kind of a competition for funds and a tendency to prioritize spending on K through 12.
So then I think that's where the inverse of the political thing happens because the people who are in Indiana, our state government, see the sending money to what we call Ivy Tech, that's the technical colleges who are essentially hoping to get people educated so they can work in the factories, which no longer exist, of course, but that's where they put the money. It's almost a sort of a knee-jerk reaction to the university, which is always considered liberal, whether it is or not. And I just wondered how that kind of political play plays out, other than the sort of sense that the teachers are giving their opinions, and that's what they're supposed to do, and that's what you do when you do in the liberal arts, and you do these things, you argue them out and all that kind of stuff, taking them through the history of the thing. But the actual political thing is sort of we're going to smack your little fingers for being so liberal, so we're going to get the money somewhere else. I don't know if that's true or not.
That's right.
You know, it's a nice conspiratorial kind of theory on the other side of the fence. Thanks.
Yeah.
You know, well, I think there is some of that, but and that's exactly why I think that advocates for public higher ed need to get on the air. They need to talk up, speak up, reach out, and really try to build a stronger constituency for what we care about.
All right. Again, we'll go to another call. This is someone in Normal, and this is line one. Hello.
Hi, hello.
Yes.
I'd like to ask your author if she's looked at how public universities are spending their money. It seems to me that over the 30 years she's been talking about, there's been a
big shift,
a huge increase in bureaucracy,
yep.
reductions in teaching loads.
Yep.
You're talking to people at a university that just gave their president a 50% increase and
yep.
announced a 10% tuition increase.
Yep.
Athletics is getting smaller and smaller. There are fewer people participating, but it's costing more and more money. It seems to me that there's a lot of waste.
Well, I have a different perspective. I think, you know, I don't like the way that money is being spent, but I think part of that is kind of a response to the reduction of state support. You know, like at my university, we've had a tremendous increase in staff devoted to fundraising and alumni relations, and there's a whole layer of employment that didn't have to be there before because we didn't have to, you know, we weren't forced to spend so much time raising our own money.
Have they reduced teaching, or have they increased teaching loads at all?
They've done is shifted a big part of the teaching budget towards much lower cost labor, towards part-time and adjunct faculty who are paid a fraction of what people like me are paid to teach very, you know, courses that are marketed and, you know, in pretty much the same way. I mean, I think there's been a tremendous effort to improve the cost effectiveness by hiring cheaper workers on that level. Yeah.
Not only that, they pay the faculty the most to teach the fewest students.
Well, but that's partly because they want because those highly paid faculty are drawing in big chunks of grant money and also private sector venture capital. And there too, you know, that pressure is intensified by lack of support. I mean, it used to be that public universities kind of provided the infrastructure that people needed to do their research, and they don't anymore. And so they're very dependent on big names and heavy hitters who can draw in large amounts of outside funding, and that's bid up the prices for the academic superstars. I think the result, you know, I don't like that system. I think it's gone too far, and it has some very negative effects.
Okay, thank you very much.
All right, thank you. We have about 15 minutes left, actually maybe more like about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus. And again, our guest is Nancy Fulbray. She's professor of economics at the University of Massachusetts Amherst and is author of the book Saving State U, and it's published by The New Press, and it's out now. Questions are certainly welcome, 333-9455. And we have that toll-free line, 800-222-9455. And we have email as well. It's will-talk@illinois.edu. I guess I feel like I'd like to at least make the point, and, you know, I've spent some time in getting ready to talk with you looking at a paper that came out just this past spring. It was put out by the Paul Simon Public Policy Institute, which is based at Southern Illinois University, Carbondale. I hope folks here at the U of I will forgive me plugging another university. But this was a paper that looked at what had happened with higher education funding in Illinois from 1997 until 2010, this year. And what you see, if you chart that out, is you can see that there was some modest increases between 97 and 2002. And then starting in 2003, there was a serious decline. And from 2006 to 2010, it's essentially been flat. And if you correct for inflation, since 1997, state allocations for public education, higher education, have actually dropped $137 million. So, you know, it seems that that's a pretty significant decline in state support over that time. And if you layer on top of that the fact that right now the state of Illinois owes its nine public universities $900 million in state payments going back to late last year, and nobody expects things are going to change very much. When the fiscal year starts July 1st, you know, that gets to be a pretty tough atmosphere in which to try and stay in business.
Yeah, no kidding.
And, you know, yes, yesterday our trustees approved a 9.5% tuition increase for students who will start as freshmen in the fall. You know, it's kind of a tough place to be in. I'm just talking with somebody who had said that they had heard that actually there were a couple of state universities that had contingency plans ready to go on the books actually to close, either to close for a semester or to close for a year if things got bad enough. You know, so the future is not looking terribly good if you're in higher education right now here
in the
state.
Yeah, it's very, really sobering, yeah.
Well, then I suppose the question is, well, okay, what do you do about that? And how do you, particularly how, you know, it's not that difficult to get people who are involved with higher education concerned about the issue, but what about everybody else?
Well, that's where the rubber meets the road. I mean, I think a lot of people look at the current recession and they say, oh, we can't possibly afford to spend more money on public higher education now because you know, we've run out of money and we're getting too far into debt. And, you know, as an economist, I have a different perspective that, you know, we have an unbelievably high unemployment rate. We need to spend more money to put people back to work. In my view, we would be really ought to be thinking about a second fiscal stimulus to try to get the unemployment rate down. And we ought to see, you know, spending that takes the form of investment that creates future capabilities and that offers a payoff down the road is exactly the kind of spending that we ought to be engaging in right now. I think, you know, partly there's kind of an education process that needs to take place. It needs to be combined with, you know, with a larger sense of how to build support for public higher education.
Mm-hmm. You make this argument that you can look at some other countries where they say to young people, if you can do the work, if you can get into university, we'll pay for it. And there actually have even been some states who, I don't know if anybody says that now, but who have essentially said, yes, if you can do college work and you can be admitted, we're going to put you through school.
The state of Georgia is not usually considered a radical outlier, and their HOPE scholarship program basically says if you have a B average or better, we're going to pay your way to our state university.
How could we really expect that something like that, we could ever get to the point where we would say in the United States, if you can get into college, you can have a college education. We will pay for it to send you to college.
Absolutely, I think we could get there. I mean, but we can't get there unless we're, you know, unless we're bold enough and brave enough to make the argument that we need to get there. You know, I think it's that's exactly why I wrote Saving State U, is to try to get people a little bit mobilized around those possibilities. I think it's totally realistic. I think it's a good investment, the good social rate of return. Speaks to everything we care about as Americans: opportunity, upward mobility, people who work hard should have the chance to, you know, the support they need to really develop their capabilities. We should go for it.
We're getting short on time. We do have one more caller. At least we'll get them in Urbana. Hello.
Yes, I'd just like to correct a couple of statements that were made by callers. One, the University of Illinois does have online classes and has had them for many years. They're intended to complement on-campus education, and that's quite a robust program.
Well, that's good to hear.
The other is the new president did not receive a 50% increase in pay. I think it was between 10 and 20%, and in view of his problems facing him, I'm not sure if that's enough. It places him about the middle of the Big Ten presidents. Thank you.
All right. I don't know if there's anything that this is kind of specific to where we are here. I don't know if there's anything you want to add to that or that leads you to want to make any particular comments.
Well, I have to say, David, I've really enjoyed your callers. It seems like you've got a good good hinterland out there.
Well, they're engaged and they're passionate.
Yeah.
Well, we'll say that.
Yeah.
We're coming down to the point here. We have a couple of minutes left. Here, there's something that you did actually touch on, and I want to come back to, because I think again it's a very serious issue for people who are involved in higher education, and I'm not exactly sure how it connects to the access issues, but that has to do with completion rates, and that it's a significant number and a disappointing number of students who start college, don't finish.
Right.
I know this is something that people in the higher ed administration are really concerned about, and they're really looking at it, and they're trying to figure out, okay, what's going on and what can we do about that? How does completion rate, does it connect back to some of these other things that we're talking about? I mean, does that have to do with, for example, how much it costs, or
yeah,
other kind of pressures that students face?
Yeah, I do think that increased costs have made it harder to improve completion rates, because a lot of students at my university I know have gotten caught by really significant tuition and fee hikes right in the middle of their education. Plus, it's gotten harder for them to find summer jobs and part-time jobs during the year to support themselves. So I see a lot of economic stress among my students here. That I think is really worrisome. I think it's also true, though, that universities need to kind of develop a better strategy for improving completion rates. And I think they're starting to do that, and they're starting to realize that you need to have better advising and better kind of social networking supports for students than we've had in the past. You know, state universities were always a kind of mass production model, high volume, low cost per student, big lectures. And I think it's taken us a while to figure out what parts of that can work and what parts, really need some help. If we could stabilize the support that we have, I think there are a lot of people who, you know, are really eager and willing to tackle those problems and could do so successfully.
Does it also concern you that in addition to accessibility issues, the cost of higher education going up, that the financial pressures that universities face, that's actually also, not only has it become harder to get in, but that you have concerns about the quality of instruction, the quality of education that students receive?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think students themselves are pretty, kind of testify to this in some pretty poignant ways. Yeah.
Is there some particular example that you might want to cite?
Well, I guess I would say, I think there's a kind of irony about that lies in the success of online education that a lot of students, it really tells you something if a student would prefer to take an online course to signing up for an in-person course in their own community, let's say all else equal. I think that it just surprises me and kind of shocks me that the perceived quality that a lot of students are experiencing, especially in big freshman and sophomore courses, big standardized courses, is just they're not getting, there's such a nameless face in that crowd that being a nameless person with an email account on an online course doesn't seem like that much worse. And I think that tells you something pretty sad.
Do you, just as a way of finishing up, I guess I think about, again, what's happening here on this campus, that because of the financial pressures that this university is under, that the administration has undertaken a very broad review of everything that the university does with an eye toward greater efficiency. So that would get at some concerns that some people might have about how money is being spent. And it seems that very likely one of the things that's going to result overall, what's going to result is that, you know, we look a few years down the road, this university will be a different place than it is now.
Yeah.
Now, how different, you know, nobody knows. But it is very likely that things that we are doing now, we won't be doing, and that maybe there will be programs that will go out of business, or there will be consolidations and things will be regrouped. They say that they're interested in particularly looking at the administrative level and things and how many people are there and how much money it costs. And, you know, one has to figure, yes, I'm sure that if there can be efficiencies, but that really makes you wonder. And I'm sure that other places, they're thinking the same things as they continue to, you know, tighten that belt by another notch and another notch, what that's really going to mean to life on those campuses.
Well, I mean, I really am afraid we're moving towards a two-track system where students who go to a public university are going to be treated, are going to get a much lower quality education than those who go to a very expensive private institution, and they're also going to be disadvantaged in the labor market. I think that what we're looking at down the road is basically a two-track, you know, a very unequal two-track kind of hereditary meritocracy, as it were, where the very, very top students who can get financial aid to go to the very top institutions might kind of escape their economic background, but nobody else will. And it's not an attractive future. So we need to change it.
All right. Well, on that note, we're going to have to end. Our guest, Nancy Fulbray, is professor of economics at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst. And her book, which is published by the New Press, is Saving State U, Why We Must Fix Public Higher Education. And Professor Fulbray, thank you very much for talking to us.
Well, thank you.